Welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land and culture and agriculture in the state. We also ask what it means to be New Mexican in the context of land and culture. In this program, we will listen to the voices of Nuevo Mexicanos who explain how the Indo-Hispano culture developed in what we today call New Mexico. When the Spanish came to the land that we know as Mexico and New Mexico, their traditions and culture and agriculture had been highly influenced for centuries by the Arabs and Moors. Acequias, what people call ditches in the south, came from the Middle East. They're like the veins of northern New Mexican communities. They carry water from the mountains to the fields for irrigating. They are the governing and a link that keeps communities communicating and working together to this day. So when Oñate came up into the upper Rio Grande, he and the people that he brought with him carried traditions and knowledge from the Middle East and from Mexico.
In 711, he took about 45 acres of land to be able to, for one family of four, to survive. After the Arabs came into the Iberian Peninsula and introduced the acequia system of irrigation, about 1 acre or four people could survive on 1 acre of land, which is a big difference.
Journalist, farmer, and tradition bearer, Esteban Arriano.
And that is a model that came into Mexico, and there it was taught to, like, the Tlaxcaltecan Indians, who were the ones that also came under contract with the crown into New Mexico, because the Tlaxcaltecans were never subjugated by the Spanish. They were able to deal with them at the same level and enter into contracts with them. And they were the ones that were contracted by the crown to come into northern Mexico and eventually into New Mexico and to lay out the acequias and the agricultural landscape that we know today. And that's mostly based on the work that a friend of mine from Mexico City, Dr. Tomas Martinez Saldana, has done on the Tlaxcaltecan Indians and their influence in terms of the agriculture. That's what I wanted to clarify, that the Spanish really had very little. You know, the only thing they had is that it was the Spanish crown who sponsored the people that came here. You know, but the Spanish, you hardly find anything that they really contributed to agriculture.
The system of community irrigation practices that you see among traditional Hispanic farmers and ranchers, as well as their Pueblo neighbors today, goes back to the colonial period. The Pueblo peoples had their own indigenous ways of managing and capturing and harvesting water, and of course they were accomplished farmers. When the Spaniards came, however, they brought with them a whole body of law and technology for diverting water, allocating water through a system of canals, managing and organizing the creation of these systems and the management of these systems and the ways in which people could participate in them. They brought this with them, and this had come from Spain, and it was of Arabic origins, came through Mexico to New Mexico, and the Pueblos originally, of course, had it forced on them, but they incorporated it, and it changed their ways of farming, and it also created relationships.
University of New Mexico anthropologist Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez explains the importance of the acequias to the New Mexican culture.
One of the ways in which relationships of, first of all, exploitation, but then increasingly cooperation and competition, which are, I think, connected with each other, between Spanish-speaking peoples or Mexican peoples and the Pueblo peoples. These ways, these irrigation communities or acequia communities still exist today, and they're still operating, and they're increasingly threatened by a variety of changes that have taken place. And even though a lot of the people who are still on the land and who still irrigate it and grow crops are no longer primarily dependent on agriculture for their living, it's still a part of their domestic economy, and it's still very much a part of who they feel that they are. Their sense of who they are is tied up with their connection to place, their connection to the land, and their ability to control to manage water as an autonomous system within their communities. And so increasingly they're mobilizing and forming coalitions to defend their water rights. And it's in the context of a lot of the changes that threaten their ability to hold on to their land and water that they're mobilizing, and in which they're developing a kind of language for making explicit connections between place, land, identity, and culture. The acequia systems are every sort of local community in northern New Mexico and in parts of other parts of New Mexico divert water off a main stream through a system of canals. The main canal is called the Acequia Madre, and then off of those are other ditches that go to people's lands, individual landowners, and they become members of the ditch who are called parcientes. Even today, the acequia system, which involves the parcientes and the ditch boss or the mayordomo and elected commissioners, is one of the main organizational backbones of the local communities. They're not often these villages and communities are not municipal entities, they're not incorporated, and so it's really the ditch system, which is a system of cooperation, a way of allocating the water, controlling its flow, settling disputes, maintaining the system physically, that brings people together. So it not only makes sure that their land gets water, which makes it possible historically for them to survive and today for them to continue to irrigate and to develop crops, to grow crops, but it keeps them connected because they have to meet to maintain the ditches, they have to help clean the ditches, they have to be in touch with each other about the way of dividing the water and who gets the water when, which is what the mayordomo determines. So it's not only the material infrastructure of their subsistence, their historical subsistence pattern, but it's also the organizational core of many of these communities. There are other organizations that are important, parish organizations, sometimes the moradas, the lay penitente brotherhood is often also a way that many of the members of these communities stay in touch with each other and maintain their cooperative, interactive relationships. So the acequia systems of New Mexico have a lot of different aspects to them, but they're central, I think, to these communities and to the people's sense of who they are or what you would call their culture.
Acequias were the most important part of a community because without water, there would be no food grown. Water is life.
And that's a first order of business that Oñate and his men did when they got to Oqueoguingue, and they settled there in the confluence of the Chama and the Rio Grande in what today we know as Chamita. It's that Oñate and his advanced group of men arrived there on July 11th. Well, they started digging the first acequia on August 11th, and they were done in about a week. By the time the rest of the group arrived there on August 18th, they had completed the acequia. And then they started working on the church on the 18th of August, and they were completed by September the 8th, because without our water, they couldn't have survived, they couldn't have planted the following year, and they couldn't have built the acequia or their houses, you know. And that's one thing that people don't realize, you know. A lot of people think that the first thing built by the settlers were the churches. Well, they couldn't have built churches if there wouldn't have been water. There's an entry on Wikipedia about the area here in Dixon, you know, which mentions that acequias were not constructed here until the beginning of the 19th century, in early 1800s. Well, that's totally false. I don't know who put that entry there, but that's impossible. The land grant was given in 1725, on September 20th. And the first order of business, according to the laws of the Indies or any of the other ordinances that were promulgated by the Spanish crown, where that first thing you had to do was do the acequia, and it's proven by what Oñate did there in San Juan. Then you had to start work clearing the land to plant. You also had to plant trees. The first thing you had to do was plant trees, you know, because they wanted to, they were establishing settlements for survival, and they were agricultural settlements, so there were a lot of people, of course, that were looking for gold and silver. But the only way they could have survived was if there was food.
Culture in New Mexico is a mixture, not only in agriculture with the practices, but also with the seeds and the types of foods that define New Mexico.
So, you know, and that also changed the diet of the Tehuas that were living here, because they, with all this introduction of the new foods that they had been unfamiliar with, you know, including bigger ears of corn that they brought from northern Mexico and Chile, those were all also incorporated by the native people from here, as well as the kitchen gardens or the huertas that were also introduced by the settlers. They were totally different of how they were doing, because at that time most of the native also were used to foraging for a lot of their foods or hunting. They had no domestic animals. You know, the turkey was probably the only one, and I don't know if it was even domesticated at that time in 1598 here or not, you know, but they also caused some damage to the environment, because when you have a lot of animals, of course, they'll be eating all the weeds and grasses and everything, you know. So it was an encounter that forever changed the landscape of northern New Mexico and changed the diets of both people. You know, I'm sure that the settlers that came up had trouble also adjusting to some of the foods that the native people were eating here, the same as the native people were totally unaccustomed, like, to wheat. But once they became accustomed to it, and they also introduced the horno, or where they bake bread, you know, and there's probably more hornos now in some of the Indian pueblos and in some of the Indo-Hispano villages. So it was this cross-pollination from one culture to the other that has developed over 400 years. And now, if you go to a Pueblo Fiesta, you know, or any ceremonial event, and you go eat in their houses, well, it's the same food that we eat here. There might be a little bit difference in technique how some things are prepared, but it's basically the same food. And again, it's a combination of foods from all over the globe. You know, it's not only native ingredients, but ingredients from other parts of the world, you know. And of course, they were already eating what we call the quelites, you know, and purslane, verdolagas. They were probably also introduced from the Mediterranean area, but it seems that they've been here forever. So here we have this mixture from all over the world. You know, our cuisine is the same thing, you know. In any fiesta we have, you're going to have like arroz con leche, which is a Middle Eastern dish, you know, very prevalent throughout the Andalusian region in Spain. We also have the capirotada, which also you'll find in Spain, and you'll find in the Middle East, you know, the sopaipillas that we take for granted, that we think that they're New Mexican, well, they originated from the paipilla bread in the Middle East, the buñuelos. So I think here what we have in New Mexico is really a mixture of global foods and global cuisines, you know, that we take for granted, and we just call them Spanish foods, but you can't call Spanish food any dish that has chili or corn, because they're from here.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, which explores the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico.
So nowadays, it's, unless you dedicate yourself to study that, like I've been doing for a long time, you know, the majority of the people have no clue where these different crops originated. Because for most, they originate at the store. They're there. They have no idea how they're grown. They have no idea how to plant them. Now they have no idea even how to cook them because everything's coming prepared.
Arellano talks about the origins of many crops and wild plants and what the acequias were like before and how things have begun to change in the ways in which we see and use the land. These changes are impacting culture.
And the same as working the land, you know, people have no idea about the acequias. You know, I'm always getting into hassles with my neighbors or other, some other Anglo community that think that the acequias, that the banks of the acequias have always been covered with willows, with Chinese elms, with the Russian olives. Well, those are all invasive species. The willows are not invasive species. They're natural from, native from here. But the Chinese elms, they were introduced in the 1930s. The Russian olives, they've been around only for about 30 years. When I was growing up, I don't remember ever seeing a Russian olive. And the banks of the Aceca at that time were completely level, completely clean, so that the mayordomo and the people could walk along the banks, because the banks of the acequias were the roads of the community. You got from one village to the other by following along the banks of the community. My uncle, who used to live nearby, he always used to say that when he was growing up, he could go from here to what today's Dixon, that was actually La Plaza del Embudo, and all the way up to Cañoncito, just by following the banks of the acequia, where one acequia ended, another began, where that other acequia ended, there was another acequia on both sides of the river, you know. Then another thing that people don't realize is that the acequias, each individual acequia is like a terrace. And the way they were set up or developed, that they started from where here in the Rio Embudo, where it empties into the Rio Grande. It started from the bottom and went up as the population grew and expanded and more land was needed. Different acequias were carved out of the available land. But once an acequia is carved, you cannot go and change it and say, well, I'm going to add more land above, or because it's, you know, they were excellent engineers of people who did these acequias, because they went as far into the base of the mountain to be able to carve the acequia. So it created two different types of landscape. The irrigated landscape, which is below the acequia, and then the landscape above the acequia. And that was where people usually built their houses, what it's called the solar. And then where people grazed their animals were called the dehesas. And then there are the montes, where people would go for firewood or to harvest piñon. And then up in the sierra, you know, they had all were separate ecological niches where people knew exactly where they could harvest and what time of the year, how they were used in terms of betterment for the community, you know.
The northern area was more hospitable to the settlers based on the availability of water, temperature, and different practices of the native nations that already inhabited the area. However, the cold climate and altitude made adaptation a necessity for the people and their seeds.
By 1800s, the extended families living on the periphery of the older, well-established colonies were subsisting on beans, corn, squash, onions, and wheat. Villages at the lower elevations were able to grow chili, and there were orchards here in the upper reaches of the Rio Riba in the San Luis Valley. We can't grow crops like chili, and our orchards are very minimal, just apples and, you know, maybe some plums, but not much.
Historian Maria Mondragon Valdez explains the upper Rio Grande area beginning in the San Luis Valley in Colorado as the Rio Grande's headwaters begin there. Mexican pobladores settled there before the 1850s on.
Self-reliance during the Mexican period and the Mexican period extended from 1821 to 1846 were premised on Spanish land use tenure practices. And in the context of New Mexico, the Spanish period extended from 1598 to 1821. Spanish settlement patterns were responsible for the layout of villages, plazas and corridor farmstead that are still visible to this day. Of the several customs transferred from Spain to the New World, the most important to agropastoral activities were the long lots and the communal upland lowland pastures. To farm in the frontier villages were allocated varas. Varas were long and narrow lots which commenced at the river's edge and extended from the river to the bottoms, marsh-like bottoms, to the pasture lands, to the woodlands, all the way to the foothills. Communal upland lowlands or ejido common land was a universal pattern that was been used around the world. During the Spanish-Mexican period, ejido commons were enshrined in every village and set aside in all land grants. And in the context of the San Luis Valley, if we wouldn't have had this upland lowland pattern, we would have never been able to subsist in this hostile climate, and mainly because we're at an elevation, the lowest elevation in the San Luis Valley, which is the headwaters of the Rio Riba, is 7,500, and it goes up higher from there. But basically, in New Mexico, even though they did have a lot of sheep, very few profited, and the agropastoral pursuits were a means of self-reliance, and bartering was the norm, and bartering was commonly called cambalache. And the custom of trading of produce, services, and goods was widespread because subsistence, because of everybody was on a subsistence, kind of hand-to-mouth level, and this area was definitely, you know, like David Weber calls it, the periphery of the periphery.
Once the U.S. occupied this part of Mexico, now known as New Mexico, and after signing the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, things changed greatly for the settlers.
The post-Guadalupe Hidalgo changes are definitely distinct, and they happened fairly rapidly. At American occupation, the entire population of New Mexico lived on less than 1% of the land base. So people were definitely entrenched in their little, you know, either in the kind of the old colonial core or on these little peripheral areas. And so by necessity, they had to move out. The population had exceeded the carrying capacity of the land, and everything was stifled at that point. So they needed to move outward. And in the context of the San Luis Valley, this was the one area that especially the Taos colonies and the Rio Riba colonies were moving up north into the San Luis Valley. There were attempts since the 1830s, but nothing really happened, were able to happen until the 1850s. And a lot of this was post-Guadalupe Hidalgo and under American annexation.
The seeds that the settlers brought with them had had to adapt to the severe climate and altitude. Some of the seeds were native to these lands, and some had come from Europe and had had to adapt after many years, growing and traveling from central Mexico on up into the upper Rio Grande Valley. Though some of us forget, seeds are what give us food, and in a time when there were no grocery stores, they were your only hope. So they were precious and a part of the culture.
In the early 1850s, the first villages were established here in the San Luis Valley in the Rio Culebra Basin, and then on the Conejo side, which is on the opposite side, the west side of the San Luis Valley, just shortly after. The plazas raised, you know, short-season staple crops to survive at high elevations. And that included frijol bolitas, or the bolita beans, the habas, or the fava beans, the maíz blanco, or the white corn, which is the little short corn that was acclimated to this elevation, the cebolla, or the onions, the abarrón, or the field peas, and the calabaza, or the pumpkin. Women also gathered quelites, or the young lamb's quarters, verdolagas, or purslane, piñón, champer, rosehip, capulin, or chokecherry, and galamburio, or gooseberry.
I asked Dr. Mondragon Valdez where she saw the connection between land and culture.
Between the land and the cultural landscapes. The cultural landscapes in New Mexico and in southern Colorado are as distinct as the cultural landscapes in New England and in the American South. Our cultural landscapes are made up of plazas, of acequias. We have a strong adobe construction, a heritage with adobe construction. And so the cultural landscapes are reflection of the, I guess, to be romantic, of the soul of the culture. And so that is the outward manifestation of culture is cultural landscapes. And that's very strong. And without the land, there would be no cultural landscapes.
I asked what it meant to be in the New Mexican bioregion.
Well, I've always considered myself, even though I live in Colorado, I consider myself a New Mexican, actually a resident of occupied New Mexico. When I was growing up, the politicians from New Mexico used to come to our community, even though we were Colorado, and they would politic. They would ride in our Santa Ana fiesta. We always listened to New Mexico TV. The weather from the New Mexico TV station is more accurate than weather that you listen to on the Colorado, from Colorado Springs. So I always listened to New Mexico TV. One of the big radio stations, the Spanish language radio stations, is from Taos. You can hear it any place in the San Luis Valley. So to be a New Mexican that is caught in Colorado is, as a historian, I looked at that in my dissertation. Three times we have tried to return to New Mexico, the San Luis Valley. And the most recent time was in the 1970s, and I'm very proud of my father, Charles Mondragon, because he worked with Roberto Mondragon, and they went before the New Mexico legislature, and they passed I'm not sure if it was a bill, but there was an attempt for Costilla and Conejos County to go back to New Mexico. And again, this was historically, they tried this in the 1870s to return, and they couldn't. We tried in the 1970s, and we couldn't. So that's why I went to school and graduated in New Mexico, and so did my husband graduate from the University of New Mexico. We have really strong ties with New Mexico, although I live in Colorado. It's closer to Santa Fe than it is to Denver. For me to be a New Mexican in Colorado means, I think I'm a citizen of the Rio Arriba bioregion. So even though I don't live in New Mexico, and even though my heart's in New Mexico, but I live in Colorado, I'm still a bona fide resident of the Rio Arriba bioregion.
So for some, being New Mexican crosses over political boundaries to a cultural identity. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappett for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.